Good afternoon, everybody. Going to start right off at 4 o'clock so that people are on time, get a break. Three lectures in this segment, one on stratification in general, one on stratification by gender and age, and the other stratification by race. So we'll just go through the outlines. I'll entertain questions, try to explain and summarize as best I know how, which kind of depends on the day, so we'll see. All right, stratification, I think I talked about it being the thing we contribute to the academy. You know, you have physicists and chemists that are teaching you other courses that have other contributions. We contribute the study of the causes and consequences of diversity. That's our thing. And so that's what this whole unit is about. Rooted in a couple of dead white guys, Marx arguing from a conflict point of view that there are two classes of people ever, and they are distinct and mutually exclusive and separated by their relations to the means of production. In other words, the factory, who owns the factories, who owns the machines, and who has to run them, who has to contribute the labor. Those two classes create stratification. Weber adds social honor or prestige that you can, in a complex society, you'll have not just people who own and control, but also people who are seen by others with relative levels of prestige. So that was really all there was at that start. The unequal distribution of money, wealth, and power, some comparisons. There are a whole sequence of slides that talk about income and wealth unequally distributed, not as we stereotypically call, you know, a few at the top, a few at the bottom, this big bulge in the middle. We don't have a football and a kicking tee. We have rather the Eiffel Tower. And that that was the big takeaway there. The fact that 40% of the population, 80% I should say, the population is within a couple miles of the ground, and fully 20% of the U.S. population has negative net worth. Was it 20 or 40? I don't remember. 40%. Has negative net worth. So those are the big takeaways from there. Are there any questions about that first fairly lengthy piece with all of the overheads and slides?
Do we actually need to know the statistics of the diagram that you showed us?
Say that again?
Do we need to know the statistics of the diagram that you showed us that's on your website?
Well, you kind of need to know. I mean, you mean, in other words, am I going to ask you numbers on the test? That's a more accurate question. Okay, probably not. I think if you understand that wealth and power are unequally distributed to the extent that they are, you know, you'll get it. I think these are rather stunning numbers, however. And if you want to hold one number in your head just because it'll make you a better person, 40% of the U.S. population having negative net worth will do it. You know, I mean, these are people that are literally a paycheck or two away from homelessness. And we're talking about 4 out of 10 people. So that's a pretty dramatic, and you know, that's sort of at the root of conflict theory here, is that the more of that you have, the greater the level of tension and distrust and maybe even crime going on in a society. So conflict theory is well at play in how we've drawn a depiction, how we've accurately displayed the wide gap between haves and have-nots, let's put it that way. What else on any of that fairly lengthy piece we did in class on the overhead? I think I also gave you I gave you a visual of the Titanic, which the takeaway on that is that your life chances are better the wealthier you are. You have a better chance of survival. The Titanic is sort of a metaphor for what life is like in general. Okay? Anything else on that first piece in the stratification lecture? Okay, well, how do we get this way? What produces the Eiffel Tower? Questions on that? Those first three pieces there. Yeah?
Reward distribution.
That's the middle component. The first thing we do in a complex society is divide up the work. I think the best way for me to describe this is to say the simplest society there is are hunters and gatherers. There's two jobs, and that's it. But anything more advanced than that, we start putting the jobs on hierarchies, and we pay people differently. We rank order the importance of jobs, and we pay people more for doing what we regard as the most important jobs. Now, that's pretty subjective. So all of these things, I guess the takeaway here is that in any culture, the more you divide up the work, the more you evaluate the value of or the worth of those different types of jobs, and the wider the gap between who gets paid what, the taller the Eiffel Tower and the wider the base. These three things create the Eiffel Tower. In any complex society, this is what winds up happening. Now, there are some corporations that will make a decision that the lowest paid worker will not be paid less than 1/7 of the highest paid worker. The Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream Corporation has, at least at one point, made a corporate decision similar to that. Usually, the highest and the lowest paid in any corporation differ by magnitudes of hundreds of times, not just 7 or 8 or 9 or 10. Questions on those three things? Yes?
Evaluation and ranking.
We decide collectively who does the most important work, and we rank order them on issues related to importance, but also prestige. And I think I referenced the National Opinion Research Center that tells us every year that physicians have the most prestigious jobs. Other questions? I think I gave a soundbite on the consequences of social class relative to social institutions. Want to just hear those again? Would that be easy? Okay, can we get out of here?
Let's do that.
Yeah, just tell us what you said. All right, with regard to healthcare, I think the point I tried to make was that the Affordable Care Act notwithstanding, and some of the erosion of the Affordable Care Act that's taken place in the last 9 or 10 months has changed. I just saw a piece yesterday that the percentage of uninsured in America has gone from about 9% to about 12% just in the last 10 months. So in any case, healthcare is a purchasable commodity. And anytime you have a purchasable commodity, those with the most money get the better of it. It's really no more complicated than that. Healthcare is a scarce resource in the United States. It's a scarce resource all around the world. And in the U.S., we distribute the burden of that scarcity on those who don't have money. That's essentially how it goes. Family, I think I said poverty is the killer of families, that it is the one thing that that breaks up families quicker and more profoundly than anything else, is simply not being able to keep the wheels on the economic realities that families have to face. I think I referenced in the politics piece the Citizens United Supreme Court case in 2010, which essentially made political decisions a purchasable commodity, in that there is virtually unlimited abilities of individuals and corporations to contribute to the campaign war chests of politicians. And I guess it wouldn't be overly complex to say the one who pays the band calls the tune. That's a sort of a truism. And that's becoming more of a reality in politics today than it has before. Religion, I referenced the Protestant establishment, that the religious affiliations of American elites continue to be disproportionately in power. And I talked about Presbyterians and Episcopalians and Congregationalists are now United Church of Christ types. In the President's Cabinet and the Forbes 400, in the presidency itself, and we'll come back to all this stuff. The next two segments of the course are two segments where we take three of these institutions in sequence, and we'll talk about inequality with regard to all this stuff in the next 3 or 4 weeks of the class. I think I talked about the economy being driven by capitalism, and that a capitalist economy will be driven by competitiveness, and those who have the ability to compete the best will win the most. And I think I referenced something that relates to, you know, resources tend to congregate where they already are. I think that's what I mentioned in class. And that's an aspect of how how things tend to work. I mean, where the money is where it tends to stay. And where wealth and value grow, they grow where there is already plenty of fertile ground. I guess that would be another way to say it. Government, I think I referenced the prison system as kind of being the heavyweight champion in social inequality, in that the way we prosecute crime, among other things. The way we define crime, the way we define criminals, or even see criminals with regard to ethnicity, creates a level of inequality pretty much unparalleled anywhere else. Did I make another point on government, or was that it? Did I talk about education? Education is also a purchasable commodity. And everybody doesn't, you know, if the race is to get that graduate degree, which the sheepskins are hanging on the wall, we don't all start at the starting line. And you'll see a visual on that in the next segment that talks about how public schools are funded. That public schools are funded, and this is a decision that communities make, funded by property tax revenue. And property tax revenue is a function of the value of homes and businesses. So districts where the homes and businesses have a lot of money, a percentage of that for property tax makes a higher number of dollars, which makes better schools. Any questions on this lecture in its entirety? Kind of makes you wonder if we could buzz through this whole thing in 10 minutes, why you had to sit through an hour and 20, right? That's kind of what I ask myself that a lot. But I don't know. You paid for it, so we'll try to give you your money's worth. All right, the next piece that we... let me just reference this social class and life chances questionnaire. This gives you a sense of who more than others is kind of at the top of the Eiffel Tower. You know, male, white, married, Republican Protestants as a group tend to be disproportionately represented on the Eiffel Tower. So we'll just reference that handout in that way. All right, stratification, and well, let's do it in the order in which we took it. Let's talk about gender and then age. I talked about it being a pink and blue world. I referenced what I called the name game and illustrated that with my wife trying simply to be the person that she was born to be. Any questions on anything under that first little piece? We've made a collective decision that when names are changed at marriage, the woman's identity is typically subsumed by the man's identity. And that is functional in one sense. But you want to know, well, you know, some women wonder, what happened to that girl that was born, you know, 23, 4 years ago? Gender inequality in U.S. society. This is where I talked about having to defend our masculinity and femininity. Is that right? Okay. That there are pretty profound expectations associated with gender roles that are tied to the otherwise nominal distinction of male or female. I mean, maleness or femaleness, from a biological point of view, is no different than eye color. And yet, we ascribe to it a continuum of behavioral expectations that go from feminine to masculine. And while male and female are sort of rigidly mutually exclusive categories, more or less, masculinity and femininity is a continuum. And those role expectations play themselves out with regard to assumptions boys and girls learn growing up that tend to be reinforced for men and women later in life. Questions on anything else I might have said, because I don't remember. Under that second category, gender inequality in U.S. society. Any other note you have that you're not sure about? Okay. In the workplace, I think I referenced a hypothetical young married couple of lawyers who wind up on a partnership track or career trajectory. And I think I talked about how, because women wind up disproportionately charged with the expectation of home and child care, their career trajectories tend to be they move slower through them and at a sort of flatter pace, a flatter pitch, if you will. Men ride rockets, women ride roller coasters. I don't know that I said that then, I just sort of came up with that. But that partially explains the 80% to the 80 cents on a dollar wage gap that persists in American society for women in the workplace, although, and there's an article on point here on the reading list that says, in fact, even though it's illegal, corporations still discriminate with regard to hiring, promoting, paying, or firing women more than women disproportionately than men. Okay? Gender inequality and violence, I think this is where things got a little edgy. I think this is where we talked about gender symmetry of violence, that is, men and women hit each other with relative frequency, but men end the fight. And we started talking about how, isn't this where I used the date rape scenario about women's crime being underreported and that rape is a crime of violence? And women who make that accusation tend to wind up being the ones on trial as or maybe more profoundly than the perpetrator. What I remember saying is, why do we teach girls to protect themselves instead of teaching boys not to attack them? There are two words that distinguish sexually promiscuous men and women. They both start with S. They mean very different things. Look it up. You probably can figure that out. Sexually promiscuous women, we call them what S word? Never mind. Men, however, we are men. We are, as it were. And then I think I talked about feminist understandings of gender pattern and violence. I referenced the Dreamworld film. Nothing out of the Dreamworld film explicitly will be on the test, other than the similar content to, I think, a whole segment I did on the P word, which is about objectification of women, turning women into toys to be played with, and perhaps even ultimately broken, but there's plenty more where that came from. The toy store is always full. At least that's the assumption in the Dreamworld video, that there are always available women, and they always want men, which is a complete and total fabrication of reality. You know, it's a story we tell. And any time you turn any human being into something less than human, or characterize a person in a very narrow with a very narrow physicality, it sort of opens license to abuse. And I want to say one more thing. I've only been using this image for a couple of years, and it became Technicolor vivid a year or so ago. I think that, and maybe even more so in the last couple of weeks with the Hollywood scandal, I think everybody needs to understand, whether they've experienced it or not, that untold hundreds of thousands of women in this country get up and go to work every single day with, among all the things they have to do with their work on their minds, at least on that list is stay out of the copy room with the boss. And once again, that begs the question, why do women have to stay out of the copy room, as opposed to why do men get to pin them in corners? I mean, that's really the heart of the matter with regard to gender inequality and the legitimation of violence. It is the objectification of people, and that goes in tandem with the Dreamworld piece. Any questions on the gender piece then? That? Is this helping?
Yes.
Y'all awake out there? Okay. Just checking. All right, we talked about age, three points of view. I believe what I said from a micro level is that age is a label, and that at any particular age, however old we are, carries with it expectations, rights, responsibilities, obligations, and limitations, all that stuff. That you get to drive at 16, you get to vote at 21, etc., etc. You get to put up with heinous things that your family does to you when you're 40, etc. You get to wake up in the middle of the night when you're 64 and actually doing the arithmetic of, if I live to be 90, how many days do I have left? And that's not that hard. I can do that arithmetic in my head, you know, which is pretty scary. Kind of makes you value each day a little bit more when you know. Somebody told me in church the other day, yeah, we all know we're in the fourth quarter, we just don't know how much time is left on the clock. That's probably about right. Time for the Hail Mary. I don't know. One more shot. From a functionalist point of view, age is an opportunity. It's disengagement theory, I think, was the bit on this one, where we talked about corporations being able to sort of buy out the contracts of people who have just been there long, and maybe too long, as it were, and for the same money can get somebody younger at half the price, twice the energy, far more technical sophistication, less likely to argue with the bosses, and much less likely to drain the healthcare pool of insurance of insured people. So disengaging is cost effective. So that's the functionalist piece. From a conflict point of view, aging is a burden. It actually exacerbates the differentiation of wealth on the Eiffel Tower. If you look at only the population of people 65 and up, the base is wider than the general population, the basement is deeper, and the top is higher. So it's a much more vivid Eiffel Tower if you only look at the people 65 and over. Questions on any of that? Age is a label, age is an opportunity, cost-effective opportunity, age is a disproportionate burden. Then we talked about sort of on a micro level again, problems of dependency. And I think I illustrated this rather quickly with the idea that we have a growing percentage of the U.S. population about the age of your parents who are in the middle of two types of dependent people. You know, younger siblings than you at home, kids at home, and also parents that are requiring a level of dependent care. And that's becoming an ever-increasing problem with the aging of the baby boom. And I think that's about all I said. Got that whole lecture done in 10 minutes, too. Should take this class online. It'd be a lot easier. Any questions on anything in that entire lecture on gender or age? Yeah. Sure. Anytime you turn a person into a thing, it gives license to it being abused. Feminists will argue that there are countless examples of how our culture objectifies women. There's a fascinating piece on the website that I think I called it The Object of Desire. And it's a YouTube piece that has been around for a little while, but I only was aware of it, I think last fall, a student sent me the link. The Object of Desire talks about how commercial advertising turns women into objects. And I thought it was artfully done. So that's just another example of what I tried to say in three or four different ways. You should click on that YouTube thing if you want to just sort of get that referencing the P word and all this other sort of really vivid stuff like in the Dreamworlds thing sort of obscures how subtle it can be also. And I think that Object of Desire YouTube video is well worth 3 or 4 minutes of your time. What else? Sure. On aging?
Yes.
From a conflict point of view, let's look at the Eiffel Tower and how it looks different. If you look at the general population, and I've given you that video, that sort of image. You know, we've got about 40% underground, and the top is, top 1% is about 16 million or so. If we look at the same distribution of wealth, and we only look at people 65 and over, the disparities in the Eiffel Tower in general get worse. The base of the Eiffel Tower for seniors is wider. There are more people in it. The basement is deeper, more people underground. And the top is higher. The top, the wealthiest of the wealthy, are further away. So every dimension of the Eiffel Tower gets more burdensome for the poor as they get older. Okay? What else? Okay, let's go back to race and ethnicity. I defined three terms, minority groups being a group that you can distinguish physically or socially, but mostly a group that's subject to social disadvantage. And it's a useful takeaway to know that a minority group doesn't necessarily mean the numerical minority. Women outnumber men in the U.S. And there are other countries and other examples of how a smaller, powerful majority of white rule may outnumber a much larger minority of other ethnics, or African countries for which this is true. So minority doesn't necessarily mean numerical minority. Minority groups are distinguished because of their social disadvantage. And women in America are a minority group, even though they outnumber men slightly. But by the disadvantage of career trajectories, income disparities, and also more likely to be objectified. Just life in general is a little harder for expectations associated with femininity. Okay? Prejudice is an attitude, an unfounded, unfair, unreasonable attitude, kind of like a wire that gets connected in your head, something you are taught to believe. And if you take that to the next level, being taught to believe that a group of people are inferior to you can legitimate your cruel treatment of them. And that happens, I think, on playgrounds. It happens in countries and prisons, etc. So prejudice is an attitude. Discrimination is an act. Discrimination is behavior that treats a group differently. I think the absurd image I used is I expressed some pretty heinous prejudicial attitudes about frat guys, and that's just a belief system. But if I were to systematically devalue the grades of every fraternity member by 20%, that would be discrimination. Questions on any of those definitions? All that makes sense? Minority groups are any group that you can distinguish and suffers disadvantage. Prejudice is an attitude. Discrimination is a behavior. How do we deal with diversity? Genocide is the destruction of diversity. Segregation is the separation of diverse groups. I showed you that that law, that segregation law, that wasn't ultimately repealed until 1977. You've got to look at that and go, what the heck? Seriously? Assimilation is the dilution of diversity, let's put it that way. It's the idea that we all should become more like the majority. English as the official language is an assimilation strategy. Functional, but we lose something in the process. Pluralism is the acceptance or even embracing of diversity, where we have groups that are distinct without hierarchical differences. And this is very hard to find, and something even in a sense that laws are put into place to try to implement. Affirmative action is an effort to, in a sense, legislate pluralism. So it's the notion that we have groups that are distinct, but we can learn from one another rather than try to decide whose one position should be everybody's position. That's the difference between assimilation and pluralism. That majority gets to speak for everybody, as opposed to different groups get to speak for themselves with relatively equal credibility. Go ahead.
You said affirmative action. What?
Affirmative action is in a sense an effort to legislate pluralism. Okay. In a sense. Questions on any of that? Definitions. Assimilation is the dilution of diversity. It's the dilution of diversity. It's the melting pot idea. You know, that if everybody's alike, we'll go along and get along. And it's an effective strategy for immigrant groups to try to assimilate. On the other hand, they trade off some of their own uniqueness with regard to culture, too. I think I talked about WASPs as the prevailing power group in American society, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, how hard it has been for people that are either non-white from Northern or Western Europe of Protestant denominations to make their way in the world. That's an interesting thesis defense. One of our grad students successfully defended his thesis the other day, and is a native of Turkey, and did a whole thesis on Muslim prejudice, among many other things. And my good friend and colleague and research partner, Dr. Maloney, talked about 100 years ago, you know, in a sense, the Irish were what Muslims are today, in part because of their relative poverty coming to the U.S., at least in many respects, but also their religion. Catholic was the old Muslim in America 150 years ago, which is kind of intriguing, and that's true. Immigrant groups tend to be seen as lazy, stupid, and exploitable by WASPs, essentially. I recall making the point that the distinguishing feature and reason for the wealth disparity between Anglos and African Americans, and Hispanics and others too, is inherited wealth. There's something like a 22-fold difference in the average net worth between Anglo and African Americans, and I made the point that today's African American population are the descendants of people that weren't people, people that were property. And property is the location of wealth. And you have to go pretty far from not being a person to having family wealth. And that, especially if you're trying to compete with other families who can trace their family history back to the Mayflower, as it were, as opposed to the slave ships. The key distinction between essentially the haves and have-nots by race is inherited wealth. That's the key distinction. Talked about Latino, Hispanic culture, just the sort of odd reality that until 2000, Hispanic, Latino, Latina culture was white, racially. Never mind the ethnic distinctiveness and richness of Hispanic culture. Talking about immigrant labor, I think I left you with a couple of images. This little piggy went to market, and the pig, the meatpacking industry being dominated by immigrant labor, largely Hispanic immigrant labor. And then, by way of a thought piece, the salad bar, you know, that every little thing on a salad bar has been touched by immigrant labor. And the value of that is pretty profound. And it's the one thing, I think, that pushes back even against white corporate America with regard to the segregation, deportation, or prevention of arriving immigrants, at least excuse me, at least from Mexico and other Hispanic countries. So that was what that was about. And then I talked about Asian Americans being the most successful, largely because they come here with the most, and Native Americans being among the least successful in terms of accumulating wealth and power, largely because of being sort of patronized by the government. So sort of what the heck factor. And Native American casinos are an effort to push back on that. But even at that, those are being bought up by largely non-Native corporations. Questions? On anything? Sorry. Yeah.
Okay, you said on African Americans, they weren't people, they were property back then? Anything?
Yeah, it's been about 160 some years ago that African Americans were slaves. I mean, they were parts of estates. They did not inherit estates. They were part of estates that white people inherited. Yeah.
Okay. What
did
you said about the Native Americans?
I said that Native Americans were among the least successful, largely because of sort of paternalistic reparations in some sense. Is that it?
touch of our hands.
I'll answer individual questions then for as long as you want. Thank you very much.